Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 podcast. Game week one is a wrap and we are squeezing ourselves into that tiny, tiny little gap between matches to chat about what has been a brilliant, brilliant opening week to the tournament. Now that we've had a chance to look at every team in action, a few dark horse predictions have definitely fallen by the wayside. But as usual, we've got a few new big predictions of who is going to make a splash. The big winners from the opening week of action undoubtedly really are Italy, Belgium, England, and of course, red hot tournament favourites France. But the main focus of news, despite some fantastic football, has quite rightly centred on Inter Milan star Christian Eriksen. But with the positive news continuing to come out surrounding his recovery, we wish him all the very, very best. So, plenty to get ourselves stuck into on the podcast, so let's get cracking. My name's Fergal Brennan, and joining me we have Squawker's own chief football writer, Mohamed Butt. Mo, how are you doing?
Mate, it's the Euros. It's the Euros and the Copa America. I'm doing great. It's fantastic. I'm tired. I'm very tired, but, you know, doing great. It's fantastic.
Magic stuff. And we also have football journalist pair, Ewan McTare and Alan Feely. Ewan, Alan, how's things?
Yeah, all good. Enjoying the Euros so far. It's, you know, it's summer football. It's 3 years since the last tournament, obviously. We've been waiting for this. And the Eriksen incident aside, it was a really fun opening round, even though there's not much jeopardy, even though pretty much everybody except Scotland will be going through. It was a lot of fun, and I think we've got a few takeaways to get into.
Yeah, I think for me, I think everyone was feeling a bit jaded towards the end of the domestic season. I certainly was, but I feel completely re-energized with the Euro 2020 and the Copa America. I just really kind of enjoying the tournament football, you know, being in a host city as well. It's, you definitely get a sense of the atmosphere. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how the Euro specifically plays out over the course of the summer. I think we have some great nights ahead of us.
Right then, Group A, Alan, we're going to go to you first on this. Italy kicked off the tournament with a 3-0 victory over Turkey. And we chatted about them obviously quite in a lot of detail in the previews. And nobody was really expecting them to be right amongst the favourites. But you'd be a fool to say that Italy, considering the talent they've got running right the way through that squad, that they could just be dismissed in terms of the impact that they were going to make at this tournament. But 3-0 victory over famous last words, dark horse shout, Turkey was really, really impressive. And Roberto Mancini, we talked about this with Alistair McKenzie in the preview, is arguably the big story from the Italy team, maybe more than any of his players. And the style that he's brought to them, pressing really, really high up the pitch, we saw that at full effect. And that tipped the balance for them against Turkey on the night.
Yeah, I think that in many ways it was a battle between a team who was kind of maybe overhyped in Turkey and underhyped in Italy. I think that, you know, Italy have lived up to their kind of quiet expectations. They pressed really high and took the game to Turkey. Like before the tournament, logically, I believed that France were going to win it. But I think that, you know, something inside of me, this kind of, you know, instinct is kind of telling me that Italy could be the ones to do it, because I just feel like under Roberto Mancini, as you mentioned, they have a very exciting kind of live team that are also very competitive, and they're backed by one of the most passionate footballing nations that we have, you know. Ciro Immobile breaking his major tournament duct was very, very important, I think. And I just feel like, you know, the kind of combination of himself and also Lorenzo Insigne and Marco Verratti, when he kind of returns to full fitness, will be so important for Italy, because it's really not an Italy of the kind of type we've been used to seeing over the years. I mean, though that trio I just mentioned, Insigne, Verratti, and Immobile, were all schooled under Zdeněk Zeman at Pescara, who's kind of, you know, this chain-smoking guy famed for his attacking football, much like Maurizio Sarri in many ways. And that's very much the identity of this Italian team, more so than the Catenaccio that were more stereotypically referred to them as, you know. I thought in this game, particularly Leonardo Spinazzola and Domenico Berardi was superb. You know, really, really good against a Turkey team who are fancy going to the game, conceded just 3 goals through qualifying the phase, but matched that in this game. Italy also get with their biggest ever tournament win.
I was going to say, that's the funny thing. You mentioned it, right? This Italy team is not built on defence. That's their weakest unit, isn't it, almost, with those two old men back there. Yeah. And it's just like, but the midfield is ferocious. The press is Jorginho, Locatelli, and they haven't got Verratti in there. Barella was outstanding. Like you say, Berardi, I mean, I thought he used the ball terribly, but he was always available, dribbling, and I mean, Insigne was fantastic. Like it's such a weird thing because Italy, it's an Italy team that's, like you say, it's top heavy. They're an attacking team. You know, it's like, it's crazy. They're really
absolutely
good to watch, aren't they?
Absolutely. They are. And also, I think, I know like Bonucci and Chiellini is the kind of the weak point, you could say, of that team, but they're still top class centre backs. Like they're old men, but they're still very experienced old men, do you know? So I think that it's not like they have two donkeys back there. I think that they still can add a lot to the team, you know?
I think you're both pretty brave calling Chiellini and Bonucci old men. I'm already thinking of what sort of no country, Italy is a country for old men. By the end of the podcast, I'll have figured out a cheesy joke to go with that. But you're both very brave saying that about them too. But as you say, on the night, the focus was on the other end of the pitch, Alan, for Italy and the performance that they put in. And mentality, approach, all of those aspects that are not really associated with putting the ball in the back of the net, tactical systems of pressing teams, etc. That generally wins the day in international tournaments because you've got such a small window where you need to perform. And Roberto Mancini will be absolutely delighted that Italy are not being necessarily spoken about like France are or Portugal or Belgium, etc. Because that's what he wants. He knows his team are capable of getting out of the group and powering through the knockout stages. And when you look at Italy and their record in previous competitions, there's so much attention of the fact that they didn't qualify for the World Cup in 2018. But their record in the Euros since 2000, they've only not reached at least the quarterfinals on one occasion. And all of those aspects together, all of those pieces of the jigsaw seem to be setting us up for Italy really, really making an impact in the knockouts.
Yeah, but also you have this story with Roberto Mancini where as a player, he never fulfilled his potential with Italy. Do you know? He had various issues with various managers and never quite got the run on the team he felt he deserved. Maybe he let his ego get the better of him in some situations. I mean, he was the understudy to Roberto Baggio at times. And I think he's spoken of his regret about that. But I think for that reason, he's going to approach this job with all the more due diligence because he's somebody who wants to do really, really well for his country. He's a patriotic Italian. And also, having said that, he's a guy who isn't a typical Italian player in many ways. He was schooled under mainly foreign coaches as a player. So his insight and his kind of approach isn't typically Italian in many ways. And unlike a lot of coaches at an international level, I think he's somebody who is very much at the peak of his game in many ways. I think that he's not somebody who's in this for a retirement thing. He's not someone who's done with the club game by any means. I think that he still could go back to the club game in the coming years. But I think that he's someone who's a top-class coach, a very polemic coach, someone who maybe isn't suited to building a club team over the long term. But I think in the period of an international window, like what we have at the moment, I think he's almost ideal for Italy. I mean, we saw the passion of their pre-match anthem. You know, this is a unique nation. And I think that Mancini, especially in the moment of time that Italian football is in, it's in quite a low ebb in many ways. And the domestic game isn't as strong as it was, although it's very entertaining. I think that a strong performance for Italy this summer would do wonders for their kind of self-perception, their self-confidence.
So obviously Italy leading the way after game week one in Group A with a win. The other match, Wales-Switzerland, 1-1 draw. Wales, again, in a situation of expectation being built around them based on Euro 2016 when they got to the semi-finals and lost to Cristiano Ronaldo's Portugal. But it didn't start in any way how Rob Page and Wales would have wanted it to. Little bit of a damp squib in terms of a performance. And Gareth Bale, Aaron Ramsey, there's always so much pre-tournament focus on them. But based on this result, Page and the Welsh players really struggled to get them into the game. And personally, I think they got away with one. Kiefer Moore, the battering ram up top, got himself a goal and crucially got them a point. And the whole thing of you don't want to lose your first game in a tournament really rings true in this one. But Wales can count themselves fortunate to come away with a draw against a fairly capable Switzerland side.
Yeah, definitely. I think that the Switzerland team are very much kind of almost inevitable in many ways. They're not someone who's going to light the tournament on fire, but they are very capable. You know, Jerdan Shaqiri and Granit Xhaka are very familiar with the Premier League. Fans are two key players for them. I thought they did quite well and will do quite well over the course of the tournament, but I don't think that they're going to be pulling up any trees. As for Wales, I mean, you mentioned that Kiefer Moore got that goal. He was assisted by Joe Morel, and neither of them have a single minute of Premier League experience. You know, that's kind of where Wales are at in many ways. They aren't the kind of player, the squad with the caliber of some other squads in these tournaments, but they do have capable players, of course, you know, guys who are going to really fight for every ball and fight for the shirt and stuff like that. So I think that they can't be underestimated. They show attacking spirit and fighting spirit to come back and get a point from this game and it was always a difficult game. And I think that they were, as you mentioned, quite lucky to do so. But I think they can have cause for optimism, you know. I think that Bale and Ramsey, yeah, they weren't at the level we'd expect them to be at, but they did shine in some moments. I think that as the tournament goes on, they will begin to find their feet a bit more and hopefully impose themselves a bit more, maybe in the bigger games. You know, I think the game coming up in Baku is going to be huge against Turkey, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's tough for Robert Page to kind of find attacking alternatives. I don't think there's a many options there for him. I think that it's going to be more of a case of hoping and waiting and doing the best you can to get the likes of Bale and Ramsey to kind of play themselves into top form.
It's got to get on Dan James.
I think also
that's all it is.
Dan James too, absolutely. I mean, he's like full of fire and desire. You could say he was angry coming off the pitch, which is a good sign. I mean, unlike Ramsey and Bale, he's at the opposite end of his career. He's kind of breaking through. This could be a statement tournament for him. And I think that, you know, he's being rested and it's clearer how he's being rested. But I think that he'll be the key man really coming forward, you know, as Mo said.
Just quickly before we look at Group B, Alan, obviously Italy, based on this result, favourites to now top the group. Who's best placed to finish second? Wales, Switzerland, a point each after that draw, and Turkey are definitely not dead and buried, but they need a reaction and they need it quick.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's tough always to judge teams' level, international level, coming into tournaments, I think, because the qualifiers can lie in many ways because of the way they're so segmented, and tournament football is very, very different. I think that Turkey are better than what they showed against Italy, and the word coming from the camp is that it's all positive there, that they're all in harmony very much so. So I'd be confident they can bounce back. I'd expect them to beat Wales, although I think that Wales have put a good account of themselves forward. And I think Switzerland could also be a tough test for Italy. I think that if Italy can go and beat Switzerland, to beat them convincingly, then we'll really begin to take them seriously. Because don't forget, there has been moments in 2014, for instance, when Italy did very well against England in Manaus, where they can't flatter to deceive in many ways. So I think that over the course of the tournament, we'll see the true colours of all these teams. But I think that they can all kind of, you know, put forth either better or less impressive versions of what they have so far. I mean, it's definitely not dead and buried by any means.
Moving on to Group B, Ewan, we're going to go to you on this one. Denmark against Finland. Yeah. In reality, a day that football just flew out of the window and was absolutely inconsequential. Christian Eriksen collapsing on the pitch, and it's now been since confirmed that he suffered a cardiac arrest. We mentioned at the top of the show, the news is positive surrounding his recovery. He's awake. He's sent a couple of messages of support to the squad. And despite the fact that he's not going to play again in Euro 2020, he does look as if he is putting the building blocks in place to a full recovery. But one of the most interesting stories that's come out of this game actually was at full-time. UEFA have come in for an absolute battering. The Danish players, the Danish manager, Kasper Hjulmand, has been quite straight in his criticism of UEFA, in that he's essentially said they were given three options. You play the game tonight, which they did and eventually lost 1-0 against Finland. You play it tomorrow or you forfeit. And given the fact that the situation was so tense and so emotionally charged, UEFA have been quite rightly criticised here. And in a scenario where we rarely see players and managers really speak out against the governing bodies, Denmark have set their stall out here, that the way UEFA approached this was simply wrong.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, this is one of the games of the tournament, in the sense that this is the game that I think will stick with people when we talk about Euro 2020 10 years from now. People will remember where they were watching this game, how it all unfolded. And I guess the criticism of UEFA started already with the broadcast. Lots of people getting angry at their local broadcasters. At the same time, it is a centralised feed now that UEFA have. Since 2008, all UEFA and FIFA tournaments are televised centrally. Used to be the host country was in charge of this. That's impossible in this case. So UEFA's feed was very criticised. And then the fact that the game resumed so quickly, and you can tell that it resumed so quickly because Eriksen even reportedly watched the last 10 minutes of the match, which kind of just tells you how miraculously quickly he recovered, but also that it was quite incredible they were playing that game that same night as he was still just settling into his hospital bed. So just a very strange one. At the end of the day, I think there's a lot of anger at how this was handled, how this was dealt with. You know, as you mentioned, you know, Kasper Hjulmand was quite critical of it. He said, we just wanted to get it over with. There's a lot of anger. There will be questions asked. They should be asked. But at the same time, I think we just need to take the positive, which is Christian Eriksen is okay. And for a long time, it looked like he wouldn't be.
We'll come back to the game in just a second. Mo, I wanted to ask your view on this. I know you've been quite clear on Twitter in terms of your reaction to the way UEFA handled it and the way that the game was played out. There are contingency plans in place for worst-case scenarios by UEFA, by the FA, for a domestic game, for the Premier League, etc. And if situations like this do occur, and UEFA's handling of this has been really, really poor, and one of the main criticisms has been this argument that they went into the Danish dressing room, they spoke with the players, they spoke with the Finland players. Surely that decision should have been taken out of the players' hands. It wasn't the players' decision to temporarily abandon the game. That was Anthony Taylor, the referee. So why were they involved in the decision-making process to restart it? And should they have actually been asked, given the fact of what they just witnessed?
No, the whole thing was shambolic. Like, you had Simon Kjær having to run over and rally all the players and Kasper Schmeichel to stand around him so the broadcasters couldn't video him getting resuscitated. And you had to have Simon Kjær and Kasper Schmeichel go over to his wife and console her and hide her from being videoed, as she's clearly distraught watching her husband receive defibrillation. That enough was bad. That was bad enough. And then, of course, the whole thing, oh, the players wanted to play on. When that was what broke, the news channels were breaking, the official UEFA feed was like, the players want to play, it's their decision. And you're thinking, in the back of your head, you're thinking, well, that makes sense. Footballers always want to just soldier on and get on with it. They want to get the job done. You know, win it for Chris, all that sort of thing. And then it comes out later that, like I said earlier, they were given three basically ridiculous options and they picked the most, like, let's just get it over and done with one, right? Like, come back the next day, why would you want to do that? Forfeit the game, why would you want to do that? And it's so absurd that the fact that they were even asked is ridiculous. Like you said, the official made the decision for them, and the decision should have been, all right, this game is 0-0, we're writing it off. We're on the phone to Belgium and Russia. That game's going to be 0-0, we'll write that off, and it's a two-game group. And that's harsh maybe on Belgium, because Russia obviously are the worst team in the group, and that was a free win for them. But, you know, the man died, and he had to be resuscitated. Like, that's bigger than football. It's much, 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 much bigger than football.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's alive is a miracle. It's just forfeit the game or null and void the game, right? Null and void the other game and then just start in round two. It's as simple as that. I understand they have broadcasting obligations and everything, but again, a man died and had to be resuscitated. And thankfully he did. He was resuscitated, but come on. Football is not that important. Broadcasting deals are not that important. Yeah.
Mo's right. Just because there were three options given to the players doesn't mean those were the only three options that they could take, you know?
Yeah.
Three options, they picked one. There's many situations where you have three options and none of them are good. You know, you go to the dentist, you're booking an appointment, they tell you Monday, Tuesday or Wednesday. That's three options. It doesn't mean any of them are going to be particularly enjoyable. There were plenty of options. And what I think just should have happened was time, you know, to play it on Saturday night, to play it, to restart it before Belgium, Russia, to restart it when Eriksson was still just settling into his hospital bed. There was no need for that. Everyone sleep on it, take a day, take a moment to react, to recover, to look after everyone's mental health after what they went through on the pitch there, and then speak about it on Sunday morning, and then look at, like Mo outlined, all the many options that were there.
But also, listen, don't forget Antonio Puerta, the Sevilla player who died back in 2006. He actually walked off the pitch when he collapsed that time. Yeah. And he died 3 days later. So, like, we didn't know, was Eriksson out of the woods or not? Like, I think that the idea that to compete in a sporting competition mere hours after this happened is a joke. Like, Simon Kjær, the captain, you know, he couldn't play. Like, he was warming up, he was going through the motions, he came off quickly, he was obviously emotionally distraught. I just think that psychologically and emotionally, it's barbaric that they had to play in the three options they were given. You know, I think that it should have been scrapped and either awarded a point, a draw for each team, or else it should have been replayed once they knew Eriksson was out of the woods and that the situation was somewhat resolved. You know, I think that what happened was a disgrace, to be honest with you.
Ewan, to go back to the game, I think we all kind of agree that universally football, the results, all things that happened on the pitch after the incident with Eriksson are irrelevant. And Finland's win, despite the fact that it was historical, their first ever appearance at a major tournament, and they get themselves 3 points in the opening game, if in any other surroundings, that would be the big story, the focus. And the game was such a strange non-event after it was restarted, the few minutes of the first half replayed and then the full second half. And Finland were almost apologetic in the way that they won. They had one shot on target and that won them the game. And despite the fact that it was a historic day for Finnish football, it's so difficult to focus on anything other than Eriksson.
Yeah, and I think any Finnish fan will tell you they're just happy that Eriksson is fine, and the way they came together, the fans in the stadium. Remember, there was many Finnish fans there, of course. And of course, you know, some of the Finnish fans handing down their flags to help give a bit of privacy there. It wasn't, you know, a white sheet or something. It was Finnish flags there that they handed down to give some privacy. The Finnish fans were excellent. But yeah, it's such a shame that this happened in their historic moment. I feel so happy for some of the guys there. You know, Lukas Radetzky, he's just the best guy, the most fun footballer. You know, if Cristiano Ronaldo is telling you don't drink Coca-Cola, Radetzky's the opposite. He's telling everybody to have a pint because he's just the most fun footballer you've ever seen. And so I'm happy for him making the penalty save. Also for Pojan Palo, he's gone through so many injury issues. Yeah. Radetzky has described him in the past as a Finnish fighting horse, whatever that means. So you're so happy for them to get that win, that historic thing. But at the end of the day, there was a bigger story here. The Finnish players knew that too. They didn't celebrate the goal, and it's a shame for them. I really hope they can go and win a game against Russia or Belgium so they can have that moment and really properly celebrate it, because, you know, to go through a pandemic, to be back with fans and not be able to celebrate in the circumstances, as it should be, of course, it's just a bit of a shame for Finland. But at the end of the day, that's the lesser story.
The other game in Group B, obviously, as Mo and Alan touched on, Belgium against Russia, was in danger in the immediate aftermath of Eriksson collapsing, and there was the potential that it was going to be postponed or even played at a later time that night. But it did kick off in St. Petersburg, Ewan, and Belgium, 3-0 winners. Russia, we discussed them in the preview show. We weren't really expecting much from them, and we arguably got less than we expected because they were really, really poor. But Belgium were excellent. Romelu Lukaku's been massively tipped to be potentially the Golden Boot winner, potentially the player of the tournament. Two goals against Russia on the back of 24 in Serie A for Inter Milan on their march to the title this season. And again, there was a nod to Eriksson in his celebration where he ran over to the camera and sent a message of love to his Inter Milan teammate. But so far in this tournament, Lukaku's performance, two goals, all round excellent, is one of the best individual showings we've seen in the first week.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, two other players have two goals, of course, Cristiano Ronaldo and Patrick Schick, but Lukaku was more than just the goals, as he so often is for Inter recently and now for Belgium. He just makes everything click. It's kind of, we'll talk about many teams in this podcast, but so many teams have good bases, good setups, and they lack that finisher. Belgium have the finisher, but they also have a guy who can just make everything tick. So he was fantastic, as we expected him to be. Two goals already. He's still going to be the favourite for the Golden Boot. He's still in a group with a couple of pretty winnable games. Maybe even Belgium go through so quickly, so easily that they rest some players in the final one. But Lukaku was fantastic and Belgium looked good, and they've still got Kevin De Bruyne to return.
And obviously we mentioned with Italy, Belgium find themselves in a different situation alongside France of being pre-tournament favourites, which brings its own set of pressure on Roberto Martinez and his players, including Lukaku. Given the fact that, yes, it's Russia and it's difficult to gauge anything from, they performed in a pressurised environment. They got 3 points, arguably the best team and potentially the best individual performance so far with Lukaku. This is absolutely what Martinez would have wanted from their first game.
Exactly, because we talk about Belgium as being favourites because of the squad, but they actually do have quite a difficult draw. They have to go to Russia and play Russia there, which they've done. They've tic-tac, they've won. They'll have to go to Denmark. The travelling they have to do is like the third longest travelling of any team in the whole tournament. So Belgium do have a difficult path all the way to the final. You can have a great team, but you know, it's also sometimes the situations you're in. Is Group B one of the weaker groups overall? Yes, but if you have to play in Russia, in Denmark, you have to play this Finnish side that maybe is better than people thought. It's a tricky path, so they needed to start this well. They've done so, and yeah, they can look forward to two games where they already basically know they're through no matter what happens, and can start planning for incorporating De Bruyne, you know, bringing Munir back into the team, see how he comes in. Is all pretty much gone well for Belgium so far.
Brilliant stuff. We're going to move on to Group C. Mo, we're going to give you the chance after the break to talk about England. But before that, we're going to get you talking about your friend, Mr. Frank de Boer, and his strange tactical setup with the Dutch national side. This was one of the most entertaining and engaging games to have watched in the first week. 3-2 win over Ukraine. But if you're a Dutch fan, you're looking at this game and thinking, we're seeing the very best of Frank de Boer and his Dutch side. And the very worst. Memphis impressive up top. Gini Wijnaldum getting himself an excellent goal. But defensively, individually and structure-wise, they look to have real, real problems. And all the issues that we raised about Frank de Boer before the tournament were kind of encapsulated in this 90 minutes.
Yeah. It was absolutely bizarre. Like, he had three midfielders on the pitch and none of them were playing midfield. You know, this is the Dutch team, by the way, and this is not like, you know, the Dutch team. Three midfielders on the pitch, none of them were in midfield. De Roon was playing right wing, I guess, I don't know. Frankie was in defence half the time, and then just running through midfield casually, like, just stopping by, guys. And then Wijnaldum was a second striker. Now, fair enough, Wijnaldum's always a second striker for the Netherlands, that's kind of what he does. But the other two, it was so bizarre to watch. And Frankie de Jong was so good, despite the fact that he wasn't playing in any sort of recognizable system. Like, it should have really impacted him more than it did. You know, and it just, the funny thing is, of course, and it's bizarre because obviously the Netherlands were relying on essentially, how do you say this? If they'd had Van Dijk and De Ligt was fit, I mean, he might be fit for the next game, I'm not sure. You can see that system almost working because the system basically says, okay, you can run through our midfield, yeah, then our defence will stop you, and then we'll counterattack on you with Frankie de Jong can run for days, brilliant with the ball at his feet, and then we'll carry, Gini Wijnaldum can run for days, brilliant with the ball at his feet, get it up to Memphis, you know, we can hit you that way. And that's a great idea. But the problem is when you don't have Virgil van Dijk and you don't have Matthijs de Ligt, when teams attack you, they score goals. And that's what Ukraine did. And Ukraine are a really gutsy team. They finished top of qualifying group against Portugal, and everyone sort of looks at them. You wonder, like, how do they do that? It's because what you saw today, they don't quit. They just do not quit under Shevchenko. They're decent. They're not a great team. They're a good team, but they've got ballers. They've got absolute ballers in the team, and they don't quit. And that's exactly what happened against the Netherlands. They were out of it, seemingly. Just would not give it up. Would not give it up. And they made it very scary at the end. Now, I mean, in the end, the Dutch are very creative in attack. Memphis Depay is playing really well. Gini Wijnaldum's playing very well. Frankie de Jong's playing very well. And they're going to ride that attacking quality to the finish line. Wout Weghorst is a big dude. You know, Luke de Jong coming off the bench. Really, really more, really effective. I was surprised he didn't start, to be honest, because he really ended the season kind of well for Sevilla. So I think, to me, they've got quality in attack. They've got really good quality in midfield. Just the defense is so shaky. I mean, even if De Ligt comes back, it's not. And Stekelenburg was in goal 10 years ago and went to the World Cup final. Like, why is he still in goal? I mean, okay, Citizen's injured, right? So fine. Okay, that's unfortunate. He's a very good goalkeeper. But yeah, the Netherlands, they're fun to watch. I think they're the must watch team of the tournament because every game is just going to be bonkers. I don't think they're going to win. They'll probably qualify from the group. They're probably good enough to do that. But beyond that, any good team is just going to absolutely eviscerate them. Like, it's just, you know, sit someone on Memphis, you shut down half of their attack, and then just go at that defense, man.
But does De Boer have a way out of this? As you say, if Memphis gets shut out of a game, that cuts down a huge amount of their creativity and their goal threat. But given the fact, as you say, there's no Van Dijk, Matthijs de Ligt may or may not be fit for the other group games, De Boer's options are depleted. And one of the big criticisms about him in his previous jobs, Crystal Palace, Atlanta United, etc., is that tactically he does struggle to react when a situation is in front of him. We all watched that game the other night and saw exactly what they should be doing in terms of tactical structure and the way they should be pressing and where they should be standing off. And they seem to get almost, other than the goals, they seem to get almost every decision wrong. Does De Boer have it in his locker to make that reaction? And do they have the options within the squad to change systems in the middle of the group?
I mean, 10 years ago, yeah, De Boer would have done it brilliantly. When he was at Ajax, I think it was 10 years ago, he was really good. But then he's fallen off since then. I don't know if they have the options in the squad, to be honest. I mean, losing Donny van de Beek before the tournament was a big blow. I mean, they do in a way because they can just literally play with a midfield. I mean, that sounds really like, again, they played a midfield three against against Ukraine, and none of them were playing in midfield. So if you bring Deron into midfield, have Frankie play in midfield, bring Wijnaldum a little bit deeper, let's say, you can stabilize the team and you can have a bit more possession and you move it a bit more slowly and a bit more methodically, and you use Memphis to try and create. And Memphis is great at those. Like, if you play slower, it doesn't even really harm Memphis too much because he's great at those things where he stands still, Jinx gets a yard of space and just pings in a lovely cross back post. And he's got the kind of technique and whip and power in his legs that he can do that from a standing position like Beckham used to. So he can find Weghorst or Luke de Jong, whoever it may be.
I think that teams as well who are going to go far in this competition aren't going to be the ones who allow themselves to get sucked into games like that. I think that if you're playing a game like that in international tournament, it's just recipe for disaster, you know. I think we saw that with France. I know we'll speak about France later, and England as well to a degree. I think the teams that are going to do well in this competition are the ones who can control games and who can control themselves during games. That's the way international football is played. I think it's almost a different sport to club football in many ways, you know. And I think that chaos of the likes of that Dutch game is just a recipe for disaster.
I just had a Simpsons flashback there with Alan when he was saying about the don't get drawn into this game of Homer when he fights Frederick Tatum and Mo telling him, you don't want to get dragged into a boxing match. I can see De Boer saying that to the Dutch team. You don't want to get dragged into a football match, guys, whatever you do. The other game in Group C, Mo, 3-1 for Austria against Macedonia. Austria are a team that you get into the dark horse territory and you think, you know, you don't want to say it, but they are. Nobody's really talked about them before the tournament, despite the fact they've got huge experience, lots of Bundesliga talent running right the way through the team. And we touched on Lukaku before as one of the best individual performances. But Real Madrid fans will be looking at David Alaba and thinking, I'll have a bit of that for next season, because he played in three different positions. He played centre-back, he played sweeper of a back three, then he played in midfield. And Austria will be confident that the way the Netherlands have played gives them nothing to fear in this group. They'll be confident of getting more than enough to get out of the group. And they, like many others, will be pleased that no one is looking at them for a push into the knockout stages.
I mean, yeah, they're decent if they can keep Marko Arnautović on a leash and stop him from going crazy. You know, they're a good team. Alaba is fantastic.
It's a tough ask.
We know this. The issue with Real Madrid is, yeah, well, yes, obviously. I mean, Alaba did his best. This, I think, that's probably the most impressive thing he did, man. Forget the cross, like the fact that he just shut up, Marco. You know, that was good. That was good leadership. Alaba's great. The issue for Real Madrid is they're paying him 12 million euros net. Like, that's just absurd. They don't have any money. What are they doing giving it to him? And where's he going to play? Because Fernand Mendy's their left back. Is he going to replace Ramos at centre back? I don't know how good he is in a four as a centre back. In a three, I think he's very good. But anyway. He was good. Austria were good. It was a shame that they won. With all due respect to Austria and Austrian listeners, I like you. You're fine. But come on, North Macedonia, who did not want them to win? That would have been Goran Pandev, of all people, who scores the goal. It's the most epic thing. I mean, this guy was playing like 20 years ago, 19 years ago. Like, it's been there, been around forever. You know, he's the oldest looking man in the universe, and he's just shut up. It was beautiful. And, you know, you wanted, it would have been great for Macedonia to do something. My son was very happy because they had a Leeds player. So he was like, go on. And it was great for them. But yeah, they weren't obviously anywhere near as good as Austria. Austria put their foot down a little bit, Sabitzer, Alaba, and it's just like, yeah, it's too much, isn't it? There's not enough. Austria, I mean, they could top the group. Honestly, they are a more sensible side than the Netherlands, right? So they can beat Ukraine. They won't give Ukraine as much many chances as the Netherlands did. And they can beat the Netherlands. I mean, that's the next game coming up. I mean, look, let's see what happens if De Ligt comes back. That could honestly be transformative. He's very, very good. I wouldn't rule Austria out of winning that game. They're very, very capable side. Dark horses, I don't know. I don't know if they're going to win it, but they're very, very good, and they could hurt. They could, you know, they could get some jabs and get some wounds in on the way. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to watch. I think the Austria Netherlands game is going to be really, really interesting because it could be pure chaos really if Austria want to join them in an end to end shootout. But then if Austria sort of just, if they put Alaba in midfield, for instance, yet another position he can play, and just say, okay, let's just keep it tight and let's just keep it slow. You know, that'll be good. Let's see. It's going to be fun to watch, so I'm excited for the group.
Brilliant. Obviously, let's hope the Dredrick Tatum's references keep on into part two. Guys, we're going to call it there. Take a quick break. After the break, it's England time. Mo is going to be discussing Gareth Southgate. Ewan is going to be talking about Scotland and how they're preparing for that massive, massive game down at Wembley. Alan's going to be talking about his trip to Sevilla to watch Spain against Sweden. And of course, we're going to be wrapping up with the defending world champions, France. We'll be back in just a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 podcast. And it is England time. Mo, it's your time to shine. Group D kicked off with England beating Croatia. All the talk before the game was Gareth Southgate's lineup. A couple of surprise calls, but generally it was based on injuries to Harry Maguire and Jordan Henderson. Calvin Phillips and Tyrone Mings both started. He kind of justified his decision of bringing 17 right backs by playing Kieran Trippier at left back. Raheem Sterling, who's been a real kind of solid citizen for Southgate, got the goal and justified his selection. The big question now for Southgate and for England going into that game against Scotland this weekend is, does he stick with what he's got based on the performance, or does he change it?
Absolutely not. Oh my God. If he goes to Scotland with that weak nonsense, he's going to get slapped out of Wembley. Are you crazy? No way. Look, Croatia, right, are a bunch of very, very, very old men, right? And frankly, for the middle part of that game, they dominated.
There's a lot of old men bashing.
Okay, guys, look. Look, honestly, I love experienced players. They're brilliant. But what I'm saying is, Luka Modric, right, that midfield is old, right? That whole team is old. And he was like, okay, look, guys, it's the baking afternoon sun, right? These are not that good. Let them blow themselves out against us like they did at the World Cup, and then we'll come back. And literally, they took England's best shots in the opening few minutes when England were really G'd up by the crowd, and then just dominated the rest of the game. They were like, yeah, go on, okay. You run yourself into the ground, young man. Can't hurt. And then they just started dominating the game. Okay, Calvin Phillips produced one moment of brilliance with that control, that turn, and that through ball for Sterling. Sterling finished it. Great goal. Very good goal. Very happy for Sterling. Because, oh my God, does that man take so much unwarranted nonsense from everybody. So very happy for him to do it. He's a Brent boy, obviously. So did it in his local stadium. Yeah. That's fantastic. Lovely story. Calvin Phillips, fantastic performance. Really, really good. Absolutely is England's best midfielder. Sorry, Mason Mount fans. I know I like Mason Mount too. I think he's very good. He's won me over, as I've said many times. But Calvin Phillips is England's best midfielder. Fantastic. But again, it was a very sedate game. Croatia are not good. They're not good. They've got, okay, their midfield is good, right? Modric is brilliant. Kovacic is brilliant. Brozovic is brilliant. Okay, the defense is weaker than it was 2 years ago. The goalkeeper isn't as good as 2 years ago, and the forward line isn't as good as it was 2 years ago. They're not a good team, guys. And England barely just won. Now I'm not saying England have got many more gears to go to. That's for sure. Southgate can actually play some attacking players for once. He can. I know it's controversial, but you know the 28-year-old with busted knees who walks around the pitch looking just exhausted. Maybe don't play him. It's just an idea. I know he's the captain and he's the big man, but maybe don't play him. Maybe give him a rest. I mean, just saying. Unless you want Grant Hanley to snap his knees into like a balsa wood. He needs to take decisions. He needs to be brave like he was brave in 2018 when he made those selections, right? Jesse Lingard in central midfield. Jesse Lingard, Dele Alli in central midfield ahead of Jordan Henderson. That's brave. That's super brave. He needs to be like that again, right? I'm not saying that exact lineup, but like he needs to be brave again, right? He needs to play. Okay, Rice was okay. We like Rice. He played well. Drop Rice. Put Phillips at the base like he is for Leeds. Mount, get Grealish in that midfield, man. Get Grealish in that midfield. Get him somewhere. Get him on the pitch. Get him that making differences. Get Rashford on. You know, Kane, I'm sorry, Kane just is not there. He's as per usual with Kane, he runs himself into the ground with Spurs, comes back from injury too quickly with Spurs, and shows up at tournaments just exhausted with no knees. Like, come on. I want to be proved wrong, by the way. I'd love it if he smashes in a hat-trick against Scotland, but and he might well do just because he's Harry flipping Kane, but he he didn't look good against Croatia, man. Did not look good at all. And maybe it'll be later at night, there'll be less sunshine. Maybe that'll help him. I don't know. Mings was brilliant. I have to say, shout out Mings, because he had a rubbish season. Absolutely awful. He was amazing at the back. Admittedly, Croatia played into his hands with the crossing, but then that's what Scotland are going to do too. So Mings, I think, was a very pleasant surprise, and I think will be a very pleasant surprise. We'll be good against Scotland again. Trippier, a left back, I have no idea what he was doing there. Honestly, I don't. I'm very confused, in fact, because Trippier is not as good as Luke Shaw at left back. Or Ben Chilwell at left back. So what are you doing? It's very strange. That seemed like he was just doing something just to do it. I don't know. Yeah, Luke Shaw, bring him in. Chilwell even, if you want to, bring him in. Whoever, someone. Have Sancho on the bench, because for God's sake, man, you don't need Connor Cody on the bench. Like, you're not going to have both centre-backs. If both centre-backs get injured, you've got it doesn't matter who you're bringing on. You've got problems, right? So one centre-back on the bench is enough. Ben White is good. You don't need Connor Cody. Put Jadon Sancho on the bench. What's wrong with you, Gareth? You know, Sancho should have been coming on second half. Rashford should be starting. Or no, maybe he's starting, not starting, because he is exhausted. But I would start Rashford. I would, or Calvert-Lewin, I guess, in attack. Instead of Kane, I would not start Kane. I just think, man, no. But yeah, there's so much more he can do. Like, the Croatia game was not very impressive. It was a nice win, good to win the opening game. They weren't very good. But they need to improve, because Scotland will come with an energy that Croatia did not have. Croatia could not have, because they're an old team. Scotland lost their opening game. They're going to come at England like a flipping, I mean, like a bat out of hell, man. They're just going to come flying at England. They need to win this game. They're going to be intense. They're going to be harsh. And if England come at Scotland with that kind of weak nonsense, Saturday night's a night for fighting. They say Saturday night's a night for fighting. It's going to be Friday night carnage, mate. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I just think that it'll be interesting on Friday night, because, you know, obviously Scotland had such expectation going into the game at Hampden Park, and we'll talk about that later, of course. But I just feel like going to Wembley, the pressure will be off. The pressure will be completely on England. If England were to lose that game, it would be massive. I mean, it would be seriously damaging to their kind of self-perception as, you know, one of the dark horses or favourites of the competition. Whereas for Scotland, it could be a moment worthy of competing in the tournament, you know? So I think that going to that game, it's going to be an intriguing battle from that perspective, you know?
Ewan, looking at Scotland, huge expectation and build up to their first game since France 98 in terms of taking part in a major tournament, but it wasn't all right on the night at Hampden. Difficult to kind of really be too critical in terms of a performance. Two fantastic goals, one in particular from Patrick Schick, that's probably already leading the way to be the goal of the tournament. If you haven't seen it yet, get on YouTube, anywhere you can find a video of this goal. Sorry, Ewan, to rub it in, but it is some finish. Scotland have to react, and Steve Clarke's been quite clear. Most talked about getting slapped out of Wembley, and Steve Clarke has essentially said there's no room for sulking. He won't think twice about slapping someone out of Wembley if they are sulking. But there needs to be a reaction from Scotland against England, because if there's not, this could be the end of the road for them in Euro 2020.
Yeah, they need to react. I mean, it was so disappointing. It was kind of expected as well. You know, you say it wasn't right on the night. It was a Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. It was so weird. It was at Hampden as well. It was as if it was like some sort of postponed qualifier we were playing, but you kept telling yourself that this was the big one. We knew somebody was going to win 2-0, I think. Either Scotland do it or Czech Republic do it. That's not based on any footballing expertise at all. That's just based on watching Scotland for too many years. These kind of things happen. Either it's all fantastic, either it's all terrible. It was all terrible. Some of the comments after the game were saying, you know, didn't do a lot wrong. It was, you know, one really good header, one incredible goal from halfway when David Marshall was off his line. But that's not really true, I don't think. I mean, Czech Republic had 7 shots on target in the game. You know, Marshall did have to make some good saves to redeem himself a little. Just generally, Czech Republic were better, I think. Scotland let them in the game, gave them that chance. You know, you can't give them 4 corners in a row when they're one of the teams that is just known for having big giants who like to head the ball. You do that 4 times in a row. The delivery was terrible, but they kept giving them more opportunities. That doesn't work. And then I guess the other problem, which might be fixed in time for the England game, was the lack of Kieran Tierney. And it's not that you necessarily lose in defence, but you have nobody to bring the ball out. I looked at the the passing accuracy for the three centre-backs. It was 79%, 80% and 82%. That's pretty bad, and it's especially bad because all they did was pass the ball back amongst each other. So I don't even know where those missed passes were, because without Tierney, you've got no one to bring the ball out. McTominay has to come and try and help out, and the whole... He can't do it on his own, and never mind even when he does have a bit of time. So Tierney just makes the whole thing work. We have a system. We know how it works. We had Che Adams. That was starting to work, and Steve Clarke, I think because Tierney was out, he tried to tinker too much. He needs Tierney back because, it just didn't work without him.
I was going to say, do you think it was strange that he chose to play a back three even though Tierney wasn't there? Like, because isn't the whole point of the back three for Scotland to accommodate Tierney and Robertson on the same side? It was like weird that he chose to do that and left Billy Gilmore on the bench. I thought that was strange, because I thought there's one thing Billy Gilmore can do, that boy can pass the ball.
Exactly.
Like, and if you need someone to come get it off the defenders and bring it out, like surely you just play four at the back and have Billy Gilmore in the base midfield with McTominay, right? And McTominay's his bodyguard.
Yeah. It would have been fun to see that duo, but no, you're dead right. I mean, the back three is designed so that you can have Robertson and Tierney. If Tierney's not there, it's like you've got a leak in the roof and you plug that leak, but by plugging that leak, you've created another one there. I think just because Tierney wasn't out and he kept the system to try and fix that, he just kept creating problem after problem. I think, to be honest, the fact J Adams didn't start was a sort of domino effect of Clark trying to fix the absence of Tierney. You can change the system. Scotland have played 4-4-2 for pretty much since football began. Like, we can do that. So, we'll see what he does at Wembley if Tierney's back. If he's not, you'd like to think that we don't go for that back three, because if you can't pass the ball out with those three centre-backs, I don't know how you even start to attack England.
We're not going to do predictions for every game, but I think England v Scotland deserves a little special spot. So we're going to go quickly round all three of you. England, Scotland, Ewan, we'll go with you first. Disappointing opening game, but it's all eyes on Wembley on Friday night. Can Scotland get a result?
Yeah, they can. They can also have a humiliating night. Like I said with Czech Republic, it was either going to be 2-0 to Scotland or 2-0 to Czech Republic. I'll go the same. One of these teams wins 2-0. Either we have a glorious night that we remember forever, or it goes terrible and it's a Friday night and everybody wakes up with quite a hangover on Saturday.
Mo, would you go along with that?
I was actually going to say exactly that. I was going to parrot Ewan's own line and be like, oh, I think, yeah. But now he said that, I think it'll be a draw. I think it'll be... it will be a draw that feels like a win for Scotland. So I think England will score. They'll probably, take the lead and they'll do all that England thing where they're like, we're winning one. No, it's cool. It's cool. It's cool. And Scotland will come at them in the last 10 minutes or something. And then like McTominay will head in a Robertson cross or some madness like that. Tierney will fizz one out to the left wing. Robbo will just whip it in first time. And then McTominay shows up, heads it in, and then just goes absolutely ballistic. And 1-1, and Scotland live to fight to the final day.
Alan, as the man in the middle, what are you going for?
Well, I guess given I'm an Irishman, I have a bit of Celtic brotherhood with the Scots. I think that unfortunately, I think it'll be a tight game. I think it'll be 1-1 until the final stages. But I think that in the end, England's attacking talent will pay toll. And I think maybe a couple of late substitutes will change the game when it gets a bit frantic. And I think England can win maybe 2-3-1.
Okay, moving on to Group E and Spain. Spain against Sweden. Big story during the game, as well as Alvaro Morata's terrible miss that essentially cost Spain the chance to win, was the blistering heat. We've got a physical manifestation of just how hot it is. It was so hot that Alan, who was at the game, has had to shave his beard off after that because the heat was just too much. Alan, obviously you were there witnessing firsthand Spain's frustration. The game went kind of as we would have expected. Spain dominated the ball, carouseled it around, but ultimately when the chances fell their way, particularly for Morata, there was a couple for Koke and for Dani Olmo as well, that all too familiar lack of a cutting edge was there. And Spain, despite the fact they looked impressive and Luis Enrique looks to have kind of got them right in gear for the tournament, the fact that they just cannot stick the ball in the net looks like it's going to undermine them.
Yeah, I mean, it was a hot night for sure. But, by Seville standards, and when you live here, you realize this, in the summer, if it's below 35 degrees, it's considered quite fresh, And it was 31, 32 on Monday evening, I think. So while it was hot, it wasn't as hot as it could have been. They play Slovakia next week and at 6 o'clock in the evening here. And that's going to be quite an experience for Slovakian players, I'd imagine. But yeah, as you mentioned, Spain dominated possession, couldn't find a breakthrough. Morata has become the scapegoat of this team. And I think it's unjust in many ways because I think he contributes quite a lot. Like Juventus just triggered his loan for another season, paying 10 million euros for the honour of that. And I think that's not for no reason. I think he's a good player. His physical presence is definitely there. He works really, really hard for the team. He applies pressure. He's a good figurehead. Luis Enrique trusts him completely. But yeah, I mean, it's true. He's a striker and he's paid to put the ball in the back of the net. And his the chances that he passed up were unforgivable in many ways. But I think that the idea that Gerard Moreno should come in instead of him is maybe somewhat misguided. I think that no matter what, Luis Enrique will stick with Morata. I would like to see Moreno come in maybe for Dani Olmo or for Ferran Torres. I think Olmo specifically is maybe the weak link of that front three, more so than Morata. And I think that if you brought in Moreno playing off the right, as he does with Real often playing off Paco Alcacer, I think that could really bear fruit. I think that Morata's presence, despite the fact that he's become the whipping boy of the Spanish press and of the Spanish supporters, is valuable. Overall, the setup was quite good, I thought, for Spain and Luis Enrique. It was kind of a pretty typical 4-3-3, but with the difference in that they had two left-footed centre-backs, which I didn't love, to be honest with you, because I thought that in the quiet moments when they're trying to win the ball cleanly and quickly, or when they're trying to bring the ball out quickly, it was a bit clunky. I don't like having two left-footed centre-backs personally. I think it should definitely be a left-footer and a right-footer.
Eric Garcia has not played all seasons. Like, who do you play, right? Like, that's the problem, isn't it?
No, I know. I'm not saying there's a clear alternative. I mean, Sergio Ramos obviously was excluded.
Well, but, I mean, yeah, it would have been him.
But yeah, it's not an ideal situation. I think that probably the two best centre-backs that Spain have available, it's just unfortunate they're both left-footed, if that makes sense. The wing backs were interesting. It was controversial pre-game because obviously Marcus Llorente is a central midfielder, but he was actually playing in a different kind of function to what you'd expect a right back to be, because what was happening was Rodri was sitting and then Thiago later, and what was happening is on the right you had Koke dropping back and freeing Llorente, on the left you had Pedri dropping back and freeing Alba. So at times it was almost like Pedri and Koke were fullbacks and two fullbacks were wingers. So it was kind of an interesting system. Sweden were in a kind of very strict 4-4-2, watertight. Alexander Isak was the kind of outlet, had some very, very interesting moments, big tournament for him potentially. But I think, as we're going to speak about quite shortly, the star of the night was undoubtedly the 18-year-old Barcelona midfielder,
Pedri. Oh my God.
Well, that brings us right into, I mean, we can't talk about the game. Mo's had to have a lie down before we start talking about him. He was that excited about his performance. Obviously, you cover La Liga regularly. You're watching him for Barcelona all the time. 37 games this season. The big stat that was floating around is that he's played more La Liga matches than Lionel Messi prior to the start of Euro 2020. And for people that don't watch La Liga, they've actually got a chance to have a look at him firsthand in this game. And you've seen exactly why he is so highly rated. All this Morata bashing is expected because he missed the chance. But when you look at the positive side of the story for Spain on the night, it was all about Mo. Who was it all about?
Pedri. No, he was ridiculous. He's 18 years old, right? This is this absurd thing. Spain had Rodri on the pitch. They had Thiago on the pitch. They took Rodri off, put Thiago on. Thiago Alcantara, Champions League winner, Bundesliga winner. He's won the league title. This season was the only season he hasn't won the league title in the last, 10 years, I think 2 years he's not won the league title. He's a serial winner. He's brilliant. He's a world-class player, right? He comes on the bench, He comes off the bench for Rodri, and you're thinking, okay, what Lucho is thinking here is I want someone to a bit more progressive pass, a bit more dribbler to sort of start all my attacks, right? So you're thinking, that makes sense. Okay, fine. Thiago was just winning the ball back and passing it to Pedri. Pedri, every attack Spain had in the last 20 minutes especially, ran through Pedri. He's 18 years old. And the entire team was like, go on, please, young man, save us. Please save us. And it was every time he kept doing it as well. That's the absurd thing. Like, it's one thing to keep going to a teenager because they're fearless and whatever. They kept giving him the ball. And it wasn't like he was spraying it everywhere. He was like holding it, making the right passes. And like two or three times, he just sort of waited for the Swedish defense to move. They moved a little bit. Alba made a run and he just scooped it over the defenders like two or three times beautifully for Jordi Alba, who then cut it across. And then Pablo Sarabia, I mean, Yeah, like I mean, everyone talks about Morata, but the Sarabia miss for me was worse because Morata, at least you can argue, contributed. Alan says, contributes unquestionably in the build-up play, in the link play, in all phases of the game. He can't finish. Okay, fine, but he contributes. What was Sarabia? What was he even doing at the tournament?
Poland up next for Spain, Alan, in their second group game, but it didn't start well for Paulo Sousa in the Polish side. 2-1 defeat to Slovakia. They ended the game with 10 men. And ultimately, despite the fact that this maybe wasn't the most exciting game to watch, that red card to Krychowiak, which meant that Poland played over an hour with 10 men, ultimately killed it off. But you do have to give credit on the other side to Slovakia. They seized the opportunity to get a win in arguably the game that they have to win if they want to get out of the group.
Yeah, well, it's thrown the group into disarray. You know, that first opening point between Spain and Sweden, followed by this victory from Slovakia, has really kind of thrown the cat amongst the pigeons in many ways. I mean, obviously, the Polish narrative is kind of simple in some ways. I mean, they're kind of always unfavorably compared to that golden generation of the 1970s and the 1980s. I mean, Robert Lewandowski coming off a phenomenal season for Bayern Munich is finding it hard to kind of, you know, replicate that form. But for obvious reasons, he's not playing with the same caliber of player. I think that going forward, you know, the likes of Krzysztof Piątek could be key in kind of helping him unlock those levels. You know, this coming Saturday evening in Seville, be an interesting test for both Spain and for Poland. I thought Slovakia were good. I mean, they weren't great by any stretch of the imagination. The red card was undoubtedly crucial, but I thought that Marek Hamšík was very, very good. A really top player, you know, since 2007. He's been the heart and soul of this team. And he's still doing it in the top class level. Came back to Sweden to get his match fitness up for the tournament after playing in China for a while. You know, Milan Skriniar is also one of the best centre backs in this first round of games, I thought. He came close to leaving Inter Milan last summer, but proved key to their title win. And I think that if they're going to do anything, it would be Hamšík and Skriniar who are the key men. You know, and as for Poland, I'm not sure. I mean, they had the last one game during qualifying, club 7 clean sheets. It doesn't seem to be a very happy camp, given the way that Jerzy Bursiak was jettisoned for Paulo Sousa. The Polish Football Federation very much saying that, you know, the onus is now on you, the players, to perform. It just doesn't seem to me to be a camp that's pulling in the correct direction and playing at a level high enough to go and beat Spain this evening in Seville. I mean, the Saturday evening in Seville. And then also the quite tough task of facing a very competent, organized Sweden team with a lot more in the tank, I think, than what they showed down in Seville.
Moving on to Group F, we were forced to wait until the last day of the first match week to see, let's face it, what we were all really, really excited about: Germany, Portugal, France, and obviously Hungary. Ewan, we're going to go to you first on this. Hungary against Portugal. The big story for the first 80 minutes of this match was the fact that Hungary won't just take the title of whipping boys in this group. There'll be a challenge for everybody involved. But unfortunately, for Hungary, for Hungarian football fans, Cristiano Ronaldo doesn't give up until the final whistle is blown, 3-0 on the night. And Cristiano Ronaldo becomes the top goal scorer in the history of the European Championship. Difficult to kind of gauge much from Hungary because a lot of this was a defensively minded performance. But Portugal offered a little reminder that whilst Ronaldo is massive, massive importance, it's not just about him, and he's got an incredible supporting cast around him.
Yeah, it's exactly that. We all know the attacking talent that Portugal have, and compared to 2016 especially, like since then in those 5 years, they've just had all these players emerge and become top class players. So, no, that was the story of the first 80 minutes was, what are Portugal doing? I mean, Hungary were sitting back. And firstly, I guess the story of the 80 minutes before the game was just the absolute madness of the Puskás Arena. That was so fun to see fans back. Some of the videos that were going around just looked like absolutely insane. People having a lot of fun at a full stadium in the sunshine, Hungary in a tournament. That was so much fun. But yeah, the 80 minutes where Portugal had Danilo and William Carvalho on the pitch together, it was quite clear Hungary were just sitting back, not really going to attack, going to put bodies in the box. And it took until the 81st minute for one of those two defensive midfielders to come off. And surprise, surprise, as soon as they took one of them off, they scored 3 goals. The substitutions, the strength and depth that Portugal have is probably going to be key. I mean, if Rafa Silva is coming on and making a difference, imagine what some of the other players can do once they get up and running. Andre Silva as well is one who probably come off the bench quite a lot. So they have all that quality and depth. They won the game 3-0. That's good goal difference, which in this group could be key. I think it's a good day for Portugal. They know they can't defend that be so defensive in the future. But to be honest, Portugal won't play another game like this. They won't have another game against a team that just sits back and defends. They've got France and Germany next. Germany aren't what they were, but they do play that game in Munich. And then it's knockouts. So I don't think there's too much to draw from this game from a Portugal point of view, because they won't play this style of opponent again in the tournament.
Given the fact that, obviously, as you say, the starting lineup, Danilo and William Carvalho in deeper midfield positions, there was this idea that this was the easy, quote, game in the group for Portugal, and that maybe Fernando Santos played within himself a little bit in terms of tactics, that he could have been a bit more forward-thinking in some of the players that he could have started. But we've all been proven to not know anything, because he basically waited, made his substitutions at the right time, and the players that came on made the difference. Given the fact that he's got those players on the bench, do you think that's how he's going to play it, particularly for the rest of the group? He'll stick with this team, not overplay his hand against France or Germany, because he knows that it's better to keep these players for the last 20 or 30 minutes.
I mean, going forward, I think that's true. You know, this is kind of the system, you make the one or two changes, but I don't know if I can give Santos too much credit, because, I mean, it kind of, the victory in the end just sort of happened. And I mean, it was a big deflection for the first goal. You know, Hungary gave away a pretty clumsy penalty for the second, and then it's over. It's a bit like that Simpsons boxing reference from earlier. You know, if you just sort of stand there and attack Hungary, eventually Hungary might just fall over and do the damage to themselves, and you get a victory.
I agree with you. You can't credit Fernando Santos for this. I'm sorry. Hungary are, without Dominik Szoboszlai, right? If he was there, right, I could almost understand being a bit afraid of Hungary on the break, right? I could almost understand it. But without him, you don't need two. You don't even need one defensive midfielder against Hungary, man. It's Hungary, with all due respect. It's Hungary. You could play Ruben Neves at the base of midfield, right? Ditch both William Carvalho and Danilo and play like Bruno Fernandes and Bernardo Silva central midfield. Honestly, Portugal had the amount. Obviously, he's not going to do that. He's a defensive coach. But he definitely did not need to have two. They're going to have the ball against the French. They're going to be the dominant side, because France are going to be like, go on then, break us down, lads. They're going to sit back and let them have the ball and try and just hit them on the break. And I'm sorry, Hungary caught Pepe enough. For Pepe, I love Pepe, but he looked his age sometimes. When Hungary were running at him, he looked his age. And Kylian Mbappe, he's the fastest man in the universe, is going to be running at him.
Mbappe.
Like, that worries me. I mean, that worries me if I was a Portugal fan. Like, because Pepe, and who are they going to press him with? 37-year-old Jose Font, who is even slower than Pepe. So basically, they're like, okay, please, Ruben Dias, please save us.
Well, you've segued into France against Germany. We had to wait until the end, Mo, the end of the week for match day one to see what was the game that we were all looking forward to. Every game that has gone before it in match week one has been building towards the France game. 1-0 win over Germany on the night. And you've been dropping little Dembele seeds and little Pogba seeds throughout the podcast.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how the week building up to the France game felt. Everybody wanted to see if this almost Eiffel Tower of expectation that we've been building towards France was going to live up to it. Mm. And it did exactly that. Germany were good. Obviously, you mentioned that they did look a little bit tired. They still played well on the night. But France's performance, Paul Pogba, Kylian Mbappe, was everything we expected and probably a little bit more.
I mean, Germany looked as good as France let them look, right? If that makes sense. Germany played, like, this is Jogi Löw's thing, right? Has been basically, he looks at what's going on in club football and he's trying to takes the most popular idea. So in 2014, he basically played Guardiola style football until the Brazil game when he brought on closer. But he tried to play Guardiola style football, right? Now, if you look at what he lined up in Leipzig's formation, in Julian Nagelsmann's formation, 3-4-2-1. But the thing with Nagelsmann's formation is, it's all young players, quick players, energetic players. He had Mats Hummels, Toni Kroos, and Thomas Müller in the team. Now, Thomas Müller, maybe you can get away with because he's so clever, but Kroos very much looked his age. And Hummels, I mean, I thought he was going to die, man. Honestly, watching him trying to run after Mbappe, I was like, oh, Mats, please, no, don't break anything. Like, it was terrifying. It was like, you know, the PK meme, where he's running after him, grabbing onto his leg shirt for dear life. You can't make old men defend Mbappe, man. That's not fair. That's just mean on him. Hummels has had a long career. He's a great player. He's won everything. Be nice to him.
I think that sums it up. We've been bashing the old guys all podcast, but this is the game in a nutshell. It's Germany had no candy, just old men.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
That's the line.
And Kimmich, your best midfielder. Kimmich is your best midfielder, and he's out on the wing back. What are you doing? He's your best midfielder. Put him in midfield, for God's sake. Like, what? Yeah, it just Yogi Löw has been like coasting for a while now, right? You could argue since the World Cup, frankly, since he won that, he's just sort of not really been at the same level. And even the World Cup, if Real Madrid let Angel Di Maria play that final, he ain't no world champion either. So it's you don't want to rule out Germany because they've got so many match winners. And Toni Kroos can score a goal like that. If you've ever watched him for Real Madrid and you think, oh, he's having a rubbish game. And then suddenly out of nowhere, there's either a laser pass or a rocket from somewhere. He can change a game in a flash. Kimmich can change a game in a flash. Thomas Müller is a big game player. They've got players, I mean, maybe not Timo Werner and Kai Havertz, but they've got players who can be decisive in big moments. They've got Leroy Sané, Serge Gnabry. They've got players, right? I would never rule them out, but they looked a bit lost. And they looked good, but they looked as good as France let them look. France were like, yeah, go on, mate. Try and break us down. I mean, it was risky. I was surprised at how risky it was because Deschamps did it in 2018. But in 2018, he had Umtiti and Varane. And Umtiti was in peak form, was one of the best defenders in the world. Now he has Kimpembe. Kimpembe's coming off a pretty average season for PSG, frankly. So I thought it was a big risk taking that. Varane was just so good, it didn't even matter. Varane was just lights out. And that's huge. Lucas Hernandez is great. Pavard, I don't know why he came back on the pitch, by the way. We're talking about taking injuries and stuff seriously. The man took a pretty obvious whack to the head. I don't know if he lost consciousness or not, but he looked like he did. That was very irresponsible. I hope he's okay. That's my hope. I forget anything else. I hope he's okay. Lucas Hernandez was brilliant. I loved his assist for the own goal. He didn't control it, didn't try and arc it. He just hit that thing as hard as he could because he knew, all right, Killian's right there. These men are going to panic as soon as the ball comes anywhere near him. And they did. And that's what Hummels did. He panicked. And I understand why he panicked, right? He's got the fastest man in the universe running behind him. Like, I'd panic too. I'd be like, oh, God, no, he's going to get the ball. But Paul Nabil Pogba. Oh, my goodness me. You know, it's like every criticism. Like, I wish that I had the patience to store every critical tweet I see of him throughout the season. Every nonsense tweet from Man United players, Man United fans that have bought the Mourinho Kool-Aid. I wish I could store them all and just make a collage and be like, after every France game, like, look, this is what you said. You're all wrong. Because he's so good, especially for France. He's so good. He plays in this sort of role in that France team, which is basically based on the 1998 France team. He plays like a sort of hybrid of Karimba and Zidane. Which sounds really weird, but if you watch him, it totally makes sense. Like, he defends, he's responsible, but then when he gets the ball, man, it's like, oh, it all just unfolds. He's dribbling, he's moving. The pass for the goal was unreal. Just a sensational footballer, sensational talent.
I think we're all in agreement that France haven't really moved from their position as favourites. If anything, the Germany win has probably made them even stronger. Kylian Mbappe's brought his teleportation device with him for the tournament, which just seems unfair as it stands. So, to wrap up, instead of asking who we think is going to win it, because I think France are still absolutely red-hot favourites, Ewan, we'll start with you. Who is the best placed to lay a glove on Mbappe, Pogba and the rest of the France team? We've obviously mentioned big win for England, big win for Belgium. Italy, going right the way back to the first game of the tournament, have looked good. Who is the team that is going to put the most pressure on France in this tournament?
It's hard. There's not many teams I think could beat France. I think Portugal could in the group stage because that'll be the last game of the group and maybe there's not too much.
You can go for Scotland if you want.
I don't know. We'll see. Let's worry about the Friday showdown at Wembley first. That's going to be epic. Portugal could beat them in the group stage, but in terms of who actually eliminates France, maybe Italy, because Italy, even though this is a new attack in Italy, we've seen them do it before. Italy-France might be the best rivalry in European football after Scotland-England, of course. Maybe Italy, because if there's one team that has a history to do it and have looked good in this first round of matches, I'd say it's Italy.
Alan, obviously Ewan plumping for Italy, would you agree? Do you think it could be Portugal? They could beat them in the group. They could potentially face them later on. There's a lot of teams dotted around through the tournament that could beat France in a one-off game. Who do you think is the most likely to potentially catch them?
Yeah, I think that international football is about moments, really. That's what it is fundamentally, I think. I think that Germany are kind of, coming to the end of something. It's not that they're, calamitous or a disaster. They're just lacking for me. Like, if you were a club team, you'd say they're lacking something that they need to rectify. Portugal are very strong, but I would be surprised personally if they could retain European Cup after the Euro Cup after winning it in 2016. I think that Italy just have a perfect coalition of things at the moment. So I think that it would still be unlikely they beat France. I think that logically and intellectually, France are by far the best team in the competition, the best squad, and have the best chance of winning the thing. But I just think that, you know, football, like I said, is about moments. I think on the night, if the win was right, if Italy had the right kind of momentum behind them, I think that given, as I said, the kind of combination of factors, Mancini's kind of redemption run, the kind of untapped attacking potential of Italy, the energy of their midfield, if Rad can come back, come into full fitness, you know, if Bonucci and Chiellini could have one last great night against Mbappe, I don't know. I think, like I said, logically, I think nobody can beat France, but my instinct, and I genuinely go, my instinct in these matters is that Italy could be the ones to do it.
Mo, obviously Italy are going to be in the bunch. Belgium, we've talked about. Portugal defending that European title. I'm not going to be the one to say it. Alan and Ewan are definitely not going to be the ones to say it. So we're going to leave it to you. Would you leave a light on for England?
Oh, I mean, with a more ambitious manager? Sure, sure. Any team can beat anyone, right? That's the beauty of football. But the thing with, here's the thing with France, right? Okay, the way Deschamps has them set up, they are so comfortable at just sitting back and like daring teams to break them down. Basically, they did it all through the World Cup. They sat back, they defended, they scored when they had to, and then they dared their opponents to break them down, and no one could, right? With Griezmann, they're so good at set pieces. With Mbappe, they have a one-man counterattack. You know, so it's very hard, right? But there's a chink in the armor, because as I mentioned Dembele before, Deschamps, right, runs a one-man counterattack with Mbappe. That is both a massive testament to Mbappe, but it's also a bit of it's Deschamps being very risk averse. He doesn't want to commit more than one man into the attack, right? But here's the thing. Running Mbappe in a one-man break, unless you can get the ball to him absolutely perfect, where he can get a shot off, doesn't work, because he's so quick, he runs away from all his teammates. He has to stop, to cut back, and wait for them to catch him up. And by the time he does that, the chances are gone, right? So what I've been saying all the World Cup is that he can win these games, these 1-0s, he can win these games 2-3-4-5 if he takes off Benzema around the hour, or Giroud, whoever the striker is, brings on Ousmane Dembele or Kingsley Coman, who are very fast as well, and runs a two-man break with just those two guys running behind onto the passes from Griezmann and Pogba. Then suddenly it's like Pogba, if let's say Mbappe racing down the right as he was, doesn't have to look up, doesn't have to stop, he can just ping it across and Dembele or Coman are there for a tap-in. Deschamps' inability to take even that small amount of risk, he gave Dembele 3 minutes against the Germans. He could have won that game 3-4-0 if he brought Dembele on the hour mark, because Germany was so far forward. The fact that he won't take even that much risk does open the door up.
Okay, fair enough. I think a little bit of optimism can go a long way. But yeah, 3-3 based on the first week, that Italy, slightly surprisingly, are going to be the big team to challenge France in the knockouts. Guys, we're going to call it there for the Squawker Talker Euro 2020 podcast. Mo, Alan, Ewan, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Hugo.
Pleasure, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Great stuff. And we'll be back next week reviewing all of the group stage action and previewing the last 16. Don't forget to join us then, and we'll see you very, very soon.